automatically apply to UPC as well?
Yes.
That much does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
When's the last time that happened?
Last year.
1%, yeah. 0.5%.
Well, they usually get 1 or 2. I think last year nobody got increases that were occurring.
This year was
last year. Possibly.
And that's from the legislature, right? We're not talking about just the AG's office. This is all state employees.
Which is one of the difficulties of increasing for like attorneys, right? Is because you're dealing with thousands and thousands of employees statewide. So
right. And I appreciate Jan's point. Is he's currently unemployed. And I don't know how long he intends to remain unemployed. The reason that, you know, I'm suggesting that we pay what he was being paid, if not a little bit more, is if he comes, let's say he came back and worked for us and decided it's time for me to get back in the workforce, knowing that he could make more elsewhere, there would be no financial incentive for him to remain where he's at. And so I'm trying to lock somebody in. I don't know that we'll have him for the long term, but certainly to get us through our legislative mandated training requirement periods.
But is that something maybe we shouldn't be dealing with if that comes up? I mean, because that's a possibility for anybody. I mean,
of course.
Any of us in this room could leave
right.
our jobs
right.
tomorrow mm-hmm. for more pay somewhere else.
I've heard a couple of third district court judges remark that, in their humble opinion, Peter Levitt was the best homicide prosecutor in the state. They only saw a certain group of prosecutors. So. That's what I'm hearing. I think it's my sort of hearing you say
notch.
He's just that good.
And
we ought to pay to get him.
Beyond a great trial attorney, he's a great trainer, which is going to be very important mm-hmm. for this position. I mean, he's a professor at BYU.
The cost savings, if we hire him, then we don't have to pay him the honorarium that we've been paying him to do spring conference and fall conference.
I move that we extend the offer to Peter Levitt at the proposed 44.
That's what he was making when he left your office?
Well, you had proposed
$1 more.
Yes, that at that level.
Okay. So basically the $90,000 figure.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a motion on the floor to extend that offer to Mr. Levitt at that level, the $44 an hour level.
I think it's 45.
45. That's 44 and some change.
So that's not the 88,421.
It's 90,000. It's 90,000 and some change.
$90,500.
Yeah, it would be $90,500.80 at 43.51 an hour for 2,080 hour.
Is there a second on that motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Foote. Any further discussion on the motion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Nay.
The motion passes with one negative vote from Mr. Ferris.
Okay. I will call him today, extend him the offer. I've already started drafting a written offer to him. And when he presents on Friday, I will announce it to the group that he is the new Donna. I got to quit calling him the new Donna.
As somebody who's called the new somebody for a long time, I might suggest that you don't call him.
Yeah, I will not. Outside of this meeting, I will not call him that. So
you have to call him that at his first appearance.
You didn't catch my promo code.
Oh, okay. Great.
Okay, thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
But I oppose the salary. I fully support and endorse.
Right,
Peter
I get it.
By far the great candidate.
I think those are the issues.
And I appreciate your suggestion.
It's 10:30. I was thinking swap started at 9:30. Excuse me. Sorry, I'm.
So maybe this will bring our civil lawsuit.
County executive.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Bob, we're on training to county executive. 16, 17.
Well, if you could, you know, maybe I'll do it. Don't fund me.
I didn't mean.
No, and I apologize to everybody, especially Scott on the phone, because he's got an important issue that we need to address as well. I just, for some reason, I was thinking 9:30 was swap.
Are you sending some stuff?
Okay.
3E.
Oh, county executive. 3D. Okay, so county executive, November 16th, 17th, back here in St. George, the same location.
Did you want to send anything about that, Scott?
Mr. Sweat?
Just me, you know, but everybody that came in down.
I know Scott and I talked agenda topics. Did you want any suggestions maybe on agenda topics?
You know, I think we've got our agenda. A couple of things we're going to do that we're hoping is going to be helpful is we're going to have actually a pretty good block of training from a PIO on dealing with the media and some of these new. One of the things we've realized is you can have people at your door with pitchforks and knives before you ever realize there's a problem with social media now, to speak. And we just want to see if we can get some of that. We'll do that. We're going to have Ken Longtime come and do some training on de-escalation, and we hope that's going to be helpful to everybody. So I think we're trying to put together a good agenda. Hope to see you there.
Okay. And that takes us to training committee. Sorry, Steve.
That's all right. Training committee, we are meeting in 2 weeks, so we really don't have much to report. Obviously, we've got the skeletal outline for the following year, and we'll put the meat on those skeletons.
Do we know when the spring conference is next year? Mm-hmm.
Maryland does.
April 26th and 27th.
Okay.
I don't Sheridan. Spread it around. I don't see anything. It's in my best interest to not.
Oh, no, that's the next year. Never mind. Strike that. Sorry.
Well, I can't to this discussion. I did get notice of what the judicial dates are for spring and fall, and virtually we're just kind of giving up on trying to coordinate with them. They'll give us a date, and then we have our event thinking that it's the same time as theirs, and then we hear that they've changed it. So their April spring meeting is a week before our spring conference, and then they went back to September for their fall conference, and we're just going to keep it in October, basically. So it's hard to to stay with them. I know there's comments, why don't we do that? Well, we have tried, and we're just going to hold them, and then whoever can make it and work their schedules around it. People are scheduled, some stay in the office, some are able to go, so we'll just let the offices work that out.
Okay. We'll still try that, but
we'll still try and coordinate that, but it's been kind of hard to really pin it down.
Which is bizarre, because for years it was not a problem, and I don't know what's happened as of late, but like about 3 years ago, all of a sudden they just started moving theirs around without letting anybody know, and it was
crazy.
It was too, yeah, it's a given. And it was too late for us to be able to get a new facility.
What about the remote in? Are you planning on offering that
for spring conference? You want to speak to that, Bob?
We're going to get to that issue in just a second.
Oh, okay.
So if I fail to bring it up, remind me.
Okay.
And we're gonna formalize a little bit more on the training committee, some of our the membership terms of membership and those type of things. So we would appreciate everybody's input on who you think could participate in that. And we just want to make sure there are people that are involved in training, but also are a good conduit for topics and presenters. So we would appreciate any input you have on that. Thanks, Bob.
Okay.
All right. Marilyn and Haley, or Haley and Marilyn.
Our conference in Vernal was great. We had a great turnout, and we had Brody Young, the officer that was shot 7 or 8 times down south. He did a great job presenting. We had our canine dogs, which was a huge hit. Okay, thanks. And I'm not going to say the horn dogs, electronic device dogs.
Earl.
URL.
And they were great. Very entertaining. People really liked hearing about it. So it was a great conference. And we are looking at Cedar City, Moab, and St. George for next year.
To add to Haley, Brody Young will be presenting at fall conference, so you'll be able to hear that, what he presented at UPAA. It's very compelling. Right now we have two openings on the board. Chris Stevens, her term expired on the 30th of September, and Joelle Rowley, her term expires in January. So both of those openings have been put out at large. I've received some comments or interest back.
Who did you send those out to?
I sent them out to county attorneys and to the board or to the membership.
Is that open to the AG's office?
It's open to
them. Did you send it to anybody at the AG's office?
If they're on my mailing list, I did, but I'll resend it out.
Will you include me and then I can make sure?
Yes. We'd love to have someone from the AG's office. And those that are expiring, they can also, you know, reapply if they want. Oh. So we put it out at large, let everybody else, and then the board votes on who they want. So I need the applications back by October 25th, I believe it is, the end of this month. And then the board will meet again November 9th, and they'll vote on those two openings and get those spots filled. So that's my report on the board.
All right, excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Amy. Mr. Skeen, over to you.
I can be very quick. My report, you guys all have my report in your materials. You can see every training I've given and meeting I've attended in there. The big issues that are in front of me right now, obviously, and you'll probably hear, for those of you who swap, you'll probably hear more about that, is the 05 issue that is sure to come up in our next session, the 05 BAC. And just a heads up for you, funny that we talk about training law enforcement, because that's mostly who I train in my role in law enforcement. But you're all thankful that I do, trust me. I have developed a curriculum of three different trainings for law enforcement that I've been giving around the state, and it's been very well received. The officers love it. I do it. I can either break it up, but I have been doing it in a four-hour block. And just kind of break it up, explain each training as I take a break. Been very well received. I'm going to continue pushing that. So I may reach out to you as a resource to contact some of the police departments in your jurisdictions to see if we can coordinate training in that realm. But I think this year, we just wrapped up the year, but I trained about 900 people this year in various things that I was doing. So I've been busy and getting around, and no problem going to the four corners of the state to do it. Came down and trained Hurricane PD down here in two different sessions. Caught half of their group one time and the other half the next, and happy to do that anywhere. So I may reach out to you and utilize you as resources in contacting your law enforcement agencies to coordinate those things.
All right, thanks.
I just got a text from Scott Stevenson on our e-attendee council member. He has a meeting at 10, so we're going to jump down to 8A. We could.
All right.
So go ahead, Scott.
Thank you. I really don't know where to go with this, but I'm throwing this idea out to all of you because you guys are the experts in this arena. But I want to talk a little bit about Brady and Giglio. Is that how you say
Giglio.
Giglio is the Italian
Giglio,
pronunciation.
Yeah, okay, Giglio.
I got in trouble. I'm
American. I'll call it Giglio. But the impetus for me bringing this up, I've had a handful of complaints and concerns about how this is applied because of the ramifications that it imposes upon the officer. Because once they have this label, they can't shake it. And they're essentially done in their career if they're given this label. In fact, the letter I just received was a complaint to the governor, and this officer is trying to clear his name, and there is no formal process to challenge whether they are within or should be within this Brady Giglio label. And so my question to you guys, the experts, is there a formal process that can be made or created to allow an officer, once the prosecutor decides that this is how it's going to be handled, to be able to appeal it to a body? And I mentioned to Director Church that, you know, maybe this body would be something that this body could be filling that role as kind of oversight when it comes to a prosecutor saying, yeah, definitely this officer is going to be Brady Giglio. So I throw that idea out. Tomorrow, Chief Ross has called a meeting with law enforcement, and really anybody's invited up at Bountiful PD to discuss where do we go from here. So anyway, I throw that idea out and just want to get your thoughts about that process.
Blake Nakamura and I will be at the meeting in Bountiful tomorrow morning, and one of my assignments is to implement Salt Lake County's new Brandy Helio protocol.
But, Scott, is what you're saying is, let's say, is if the officer didn't like Salt Lake's decision, are you asking for then a higher review board or an appeals board above that? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, is that possible?
Well, I want to talk just a little bit high level about what Brady Giglio is. First, if there's exculpatory evidence in a case that suggests maybe a defendant isn't as guilty as might otherwise be thought, we have an obligation to share that information. That's really not where I think the police are pushing back. They're pushing back on the Giglio line of cases, which is that we have an obligation to turn over impeachment evidence against our witnesses, which most often become law enforcement officers. The rules of evidence outline what qualifies as impeachment. And so if there's information about an officer that qualifies under the rules of evidence, there's no way for us to say, well, we don't have to turn that over because somebody else disagrees.
And there is a requirement there on knowledge or that you know about or that you reasonably can obtain.
Well, the rule of criminal procedure does add the knowledge element to prosecutors, but the line of cases assume that we're a Borg and everything that the police department knows, the prosecutor knows.
So if an officer were to have changed agencies and the new agency doesn't know about that, and then we don't know about that, then we wouldn't need to turn that over. But if we found out about it, then we do have to turn those things over. We had a case, just so you know, where an officer was found to have lied. The judge ruled that he felt the officer lied to him on the stand. And so we provide a copy of that judge's decision to everybody on this officer. And we've looked for an opportunity to try and rectify that, because we don't believe the officer lied. We believe that the judge felt like he was lied to because it wasn't as straightforward as he thought it should be. We looked for an opportunity. We haven't had one yet. We're still looking for that right case, the right set of facts to go in and to put that officer on the stand. And actually, we asked for information about the judge, saying he wanted to make history or something like this. There were quite a few statements made by the judge. We're going to simply put up the information about the judge about that and hopefully get a new ruling from a different judge saying that it wasn't a lie.
Right. And actually, Salt Lake County is dealing with the same situation with a sergeant from West Valley City. That we think very highly of that sergeant, but a federal judge, Wadops, issued a ruling that called him a liar. And so we have an obligation to turn that over, but we also turn over an investigative report that suggests that Judge Wadops was mistaken, and we argue to the judges that that should not be allowed to be presented to the jury. Our obligations are met under Brady Giglio by turning the evidence over to defense. We don't have to agree to let that evidence be presented in court.
Right.
And Salt Lake County has been and continues to be committed to fighting in those situations where there may be impeachment evidence, but it's disputable or not something that everybody agrees to.
Scott, Greg Fairbush here. I think we all agree that if a judge makes a finding, certainly there's an obligation, or if there's some sort of adjudication. I think where the gap is, and in my understanding, tomorrow that issue will arise, so we might as well have this be aware of it, which is if there's an issue that's brought within the agency, or there's an action or a claim of either Brady or Giglio within the law enforcement agency, how is law enforcement addressing that and making that initial determination as to whether or not to provide that to the DA's office? And right now, where there is no statewide protocol or policy, the DA's office, all prosecutorial agencies are asking for everything. I think really the responsibility lies on law enforcement to ensure your officers have due process of a property right that is well established, and do that internally before just turning over files. I think. So I think really law enforcement has to decide what they're going to do and how they're going to address it to protect prosecutors and the entire judicial system to ensure those convictions stand up and the prosecutors and defendants have access to what has been determined to be Brady Giglio, right? I mean, nobody's...
Well, and I want to...
Even your policy doesn't say that you're going to be the adjudicator of what is Brady or what is Giglio.
No, we look at evidence provided by the department.
Yeah.
Our first level is to look at whether it qualifies as impeachment under the rules of evidence. And then we look at whether it's material to the case at hand, and that's a case-specific determination. Nobody is automatically Brady Giglio impaired under Salt Lake County's protocol. But I do want to talk just very briefly about this idea of due process that police are entitled to. Criminal prosecutors are depriving people of liberty and sometimes even their life. That's what we do when we prosecute a criminal case. And so while I have great respect for law enforcement, and the overwhelming majority of law enforcement operates with full integrity, we are talking about whether we guarantee due process to people that we're going to take away their liberty and sometimes even their life. And so when we're talking about the interest of due process, there is a real fundamental interest of due process for the people that we charge with crimes that we have to meet under the Constitution.
Well, let me give you an example. Somebody, what I'm speaking of, which is somebody claims an officer is racist, right? Well, he said or used a stereotypical name for a particular individual. I think he's racist. All right, well, and he's an investigator on a case that involves that particular culture. So do we now just tell everybody in the world that he's been accused of being racist when in fact it really has no basis and it's even malicious to an extent? I think there just has to be. I'm not saying we deprive the defendant of due process. I'm saying we just ensure malicious and unvalidated accusations are vetted at an earlier process to protect the officer from those things, right?
True.
So, I don't know that I have the answer.
Scott asking the question, is there something that POST can do if we added legislation that would help them be a clearinghouse to deciding some of the gray area questions?
Yeah.
And that doesn't even mean that judges would have to rely on it, but it would at least provide us ethical and political cover to say, hey, this person was cleared of a Brady Giglio violation or an act of dishonesty by POST, where maybe right now they're not as actively investigating some of these things that aren't crimes, but are possibly Giglio material. Could we use them to... Can we all help each other by having a little bit more finality through posts, beefing up posts, investigations on those kind of questions?
Did you hear that, Scott? That was Ryan Robinson. Did you hear his comment?
I heard it was kind of broken up.
So are you looking, can you hear, Ryan, come over here close to the phone and say it again.
So Scott, one question I had, and I thought it might even be one of your questions, is there a way that either through your POST policy or through legislation that we could enhance POST's ability to investigate things that aren't necessarily crimes committed by officers but are acts of dishonesty or other things that could fall under Giglio, so that we could use your department as a clearinghouse to make some of these decisions that would provide some ethical and political cover for prosecutors, and also give some due process to law enforcement?
I think that we have to be carefully drafted and written because we find ourselves in a difficult situation because we look at primarily violations of state criminal violations. And we got out of the business of, you know, getting into policies and stuff like that. But I think we could easily craft a good law to make sure that it's very narrowly focused on these types of issues. But, you know, listening to the discussion, there's really two issues that we're dealing with. And one is, from an administrative end, on the law enforcement side, what information should be pushed up to the prosecutors, and two, if an in-court statement by a judge is thrown out there, how do you overcome that? Can you overcome something like that? And that's, I think, some of the frustration with some of the officers in the state, including the FOP. Where do we go from here? What does an officer do if a judge says, you're a liar, I think you're lying?
Well, I think the remedy is not to hide that information, it's to provide more information and improved, more accurate information. Under the Giglio line of cases, if a judge calls an officer a liar, that is going to be about as blatant of a Giglio relevant case, and that's just going to follow the officer. We are going to have to turn that over. That doesn't mean we turn it over and we say, okay, good luck, do whatever you want with this. We can, and in the case of the West Valley officer, we provided supplemental reports, and we're arguing, we're trying to get a judge to rule that his credibility is not in question, so that we can at least justify not turning it over at that point because we have contradictory judges at a minimum.
I think what you just said, though, is the only alternative that we have. We, as prosecutors, it's our obligation under Brady Giglio to make that analysis, and then when we're wrong, we get punished and our cases suffer, right? And it's the judge on that individual case that is making that determination of whether or not we made the wrong decision, right? We cannot set up some other or some other clearinghouse that relieves us of that obligation.
Right.
I've done a lot of this. We have a lot of issues, probably the second most issues in the state. This is Jeff Bierman, Scott.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. We had a similar circumstance where we had an officer who's absolutely 100% honest, accused of lying. Trial court said no. On appeal, the appellate court said yes. He has no recourse, and it's going to destroy his career. But my point is we can't do this by legislation. It would have to be by rule. So in other words, the legislature would have to vote on something by 2/3 majority, or you have to get a rules committee to run a rule saying this is what falls as a Giglio disclosure and this is what doesn't. Because right now, even in Salt Lake, Utah, Davis, all the counties, what is impeachment evidence is not black and white. What falls under that and what doesn't. We have a rule that we crafted, I've seen Salt Lake's draft, I believe. They're close, but there's no question that an officer in one jurisdiction would be put on a list and an officer in another jurisdiction would not. And that isn't fair. So I would propose that if we could, and there's a great risk to this, ask a rules committee to address the issue, we could get some clarity to cover our butts and allow the officers some due process system. But short of that, I don't think there's much we can do.
I think that situation came up in our jurisdiction where a judge made a ruling like that we would do an investigation. We would not call it an internal affairs investigation because we don't want to release those, but we would do an investigation. And then, like you said earlier, both of those documents would be released.
Well, isn't that essentially a perjury allegation by the judge?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's a criminal charge. Why wouldn't that be investigated and then by a separate uninvolved agency?
Because, well, the rules of evidence talk about a reputation or specific incidents. It doesn't. 609 talks about criminal charges,
right.
But there's a whole swath that doesn't get to criminal level that we still have an obligation to turn over.
Which can include bias too.
Right, or motive to misrepresent.
I can see how it would be helpful to have further rules, but still, at the end of the day, when you have a rule that helps clarify, it's still a judge that's making a final decision on those rules.
No, that's
right?
A Supreme Court rule. We'd be safe.
Sure, but that rule applies to a case which is overseen by a judge. And so whether or not we've complied with the rule is still a decision that's made by a judge.
Sure.
I love the discussion, and Jeff, I like what your thoughts are. I've got to leave for another meeting, but I just wanted to throw this out there just to get you guys thinking about what can law enforcement do? What can we do as a criminal justice system to help, you know, make sure that if an officer is labeled this, it is deserved and proven. So anyway, I appreciate the discussion.
Well, thanks, Scott. I mean, I'll just leave it at that. Thanks. If you need to bring this up again, we can talk about it after this meeting in Bountiful tomorrow in January.
Yeah.
I think it's a good discussion to continue.
Yeah. Good discussion to continue, Scott.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
discussion. I don't think anybody nationally has this figured out, right? I mean, there's not an answer. There's not like another state to go, oh,